Okay, real talk. When did paying someone back become social media?
What do you mean?
Like, say I want to see what you're doing and who you're hanging with, and you're not posting about it on your story. I can just stalk your pay app and find out what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, that's weird. You do that?
No, I don't do that. I use Apple Cash. It's built into your iPhone, easy and secure. You can send and receive money right in messages and keep it between friends, and then use that money to buy something at a store with Apple Pay.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Maybe.
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous Crime is a production of iHeartRadio.
Elizabeth Dutton.
Zarin Burnett.
Do you know what's ridiculous?
I do.
No, you don't.
Yeah, I do.
No,
watch this.
Prove it.
Step back.
All right.
Did you ever have a Snuggie?
A what?
A Snuggie, like those blankets that you kind of wear as like a modified robe.
Do I look like a person
yeah,
who would
you
have
do.
A blanket that I wear?
Yeah.
I do?
Yeah.
I would have a robe. I like blankets, so I don't need to
it's
have
like, you know what I'm like, talking about, though, yeah.
I think so, yeah. I remember people would sit on couches and they would have like this robe drape
it's
thing.
Like, yeah, it's like
I remember
a blanket,
the late night commercials for
yeah,
them.
Like a blanket with armholes.
Yeah, exactly.
I never had one.
Yeah, no, I remember the ads.
But there's a movement in coziness in this world.
I figure you are into this.
Yeah. I've seen these things that are like oversized sweatshirts that come like down to your shins.
Oh, okay.
And it's like a big fuzzy blanket, but it's got a hood. Uh-huh. It's like a giant, giant hoodie.
Sure.
Do you know who else likes those?
Shaquille O'Neal.
They're wild up there. Wendy's Canada.
Wendy's
the Wendy's restaurant.
Oh, the restaurant Wendy's. I didn't even put
Wendy's,
that together.
Wendy's Canada, though.
Okay.
They're wild, dude.
They got a whole different vibe.
They have totally different promotions
different
and ads. Mm-hmm. They had a thing a couple years ago.
Burgers are round. They're not even square.
Right? They're like, what?
They're triangular.
NF Tendies. Mm-hmm. They had like this whole campaign
really?
That won like a Webby Award or was nominated.
Oh, good for them. Way to go.
Anyhow, so they had this thing not too long ago, but I think it's expired. That you could get a Nuggie. It's their version of a Snuggie.
So it's
printed like the skin of a chicken nugget.
So it's dinner I can wear?
Yeah. And it's like a hoodie. It's fleece lined.
Oh.
It's something you would totally wear.
Yeah.
Super cozy. It has a pocket in the front, the little kangaroo. But then in front of the pocket, there's another pocket where it fits a container of chicken nuggets. Or as Baby Yoda would sing, Chicky Nuggies. So I hereby declare that ridiculous, but also I kind of want one.
Oh, my God. That just sounds hot.
Chicken. You're always so bundled up and you
wear
a lot
hoodies,
of...
but I wouldn't want... I don't like ever-present clothing like that. Like to be just swaddled. Now that sounds hot.
Yeah, I like to be swaddled.
Yeah, no. you got a second? How's your voice? You doing okay?
You know, we're fighting the good fight. Apparently, there was an article in SF Gate that there's this cough going around the Bay Area.
Ah.
And I have a cough, but I know other people who have it, but I feel like I'm the only one who's losing her voice on this one.
Yeah, interesting.
And that's the gods are smiting me and telling me to shut my pie hole. But I refuse. Je refuse. So, yeah, it comes and goes. So I apologize for how grating this may sound, but, you know, I'm doing the best I can.
Hang in there, Chief.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I got something for you that's ridiculous. You got a second?
Oh, God, I do.
Skyjacking.
Oh, that is ridiculous.
Right? You know I love it, Elizabeth. I've got a hell of a story for you today.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one, it's like part two of a previous story.
Oh, really?
Yeah, do you remember Garrett Brock Trapnell?
I sure do.
You do? Okay. Yeah. The skyjacker who had his girlfriend like hijack a helicopter to break him out of prison. Well, do you remember how he had another guy with him when he was trying to break out?
Yeah, I do.
They were in the yard and they were waving and then the FBI was in the helicopter. This is the story of the other guy.
No way.
He was also a skyjacker.
Wait,
yes.
Two skyjackers,
unrelated,
one prison?
Totally unrelated, just met in prison, got along, had common interests.
Oh, wow.
And his story, even more ridiculous. This is Ridiculous Crime, a podcast about absurd and outrageous capers, heists, and cons. It's always 99% murder-free and 100% ridiculous.
Yeah.
Put you back into it. Plane travel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We've talked about this. You talked about the guy who had that crappy time on a plane.
Right?
Made a big stink in there.
Yeah.
Well, these days, in the era of viral clips, there are plenty of outlandish stories. You can't even go like a week without there being a plane story, it seems.
Totally.
Right?
Well, just, and for Boeing.
Oh, yeah. Then there's also the news stories, too. I just mean with people acting poorly on planes, not the planes acting poorly.
And it's always, you can see someone kind of in a window seat filming something in the aisle, and they're trying to be subtle. So it's like from a low angle.
Exactly. Yeah. As someone walks past, like shrieking backwards at other people. Yeah. So there's also whole social media accounts now. Like on Instagram, there's one about badly behaved plane travelers.
Well, that's got to be chock full of content.
It is. They have enough that they can just constantly post. Could you imagine if we had social media during the jet age, like when it first started?
Oh, no. There's a lot of stuff when I look back in time and I'm like, could you imagine if we had social media then? And for most of it, I'm really grateful. If I'm involved, I'm really grateful we didn't have it back then.
Well, in this case, like, I think it would be kind of the opposite of the normal trend. This is like the captured opulence of jet age travel.
Yeah. I don't think you'd see people behaving so poor. People got dressed up to get on a plane and they behaved themselves in public. Mm-hmm. People don't behave in public anymore.
No, they do not.
No, we're failing as a society.
A jet used to be exciting. Like in 1958, Boeing brought out the 707. Mm-hmm. That was America's first jet airliner. We were not the first to have a jet airliner, but that was our first.
This big old jet airliner.
Yeah, you know, bingo jet. Had his light on. So 1959, first year, bunch of people cross the Atlantic by plane. In fact, more people crossed the Atlantic by plane than by ship. First year ever, 1959. Huh. Thus marking the beginning of the jet age, right?
Yeah.
So this means basically in the 1960s, it becomes popular, democratized. It becomes something accessible for more people. This is the era of Pan Am and TWA, all the big American transatlantic airlines.
The flight attendants, stewardesses in those days had like a carving station that they'd take down the aisle.
Exactly.
People who were all dressed up and had giant seats. And,
totally. Yeah. Like legit prime rib, lobster buffet. You're getting like seven cocktails. It's ridiculous. The spiral staircase going down.
Totally.
It was like, where's the spiral staircase go? Oh, the whole other floor of seats we have. The buffet's better on the second floor. What? It was nuts, right? Well, I never got to fly like that. I never saw it myself, but I've seen photos. I know it's real. I can imagine it, if you will.
Yeah, it predates me, but
totally.
It feels like something that I could believe in.
Yeah, it's very kingly, but I want to believe in it.
Yeah.
But also, like these days, the way we fly now is... It's basically like how taking a Greyhound bus used to be then.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it'll get you there. Like,
yeah.
Most likely. Probably be delayed, but you'll get you there. Now, as I was saying, if we had social media in the jet age, right, it also would have documented the skyjacker era.
Oh, that's true.
Right?
That's the boom in 70s.
Yeah, some influencer live streaming D.B. Cooper on the plane.
Like, oh, my God.
There'd be no mysteries anymore.
And then they'd be like, dox him, and everyone would figure out who he is.
Exactly. Yeah. You take him like 17 hours, your people on Reddit would have him.
Totally.
Boom, done. So, as I said, we've discussed the golden age of skyjacking before with Garrett Brock Trapnell, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to go into all of it, but for a brief recap, skyjacking basically becomes a thing in the mid-60s. That's where you hijack a plane and you hold it for ransom and say, I either want it for political reasons, like give me some prisoners back or give me some cash and I'm going to go to Cuba.
Yeah.
But it's basically a hijacking with a ransom intent, right? But it wasn't always, as I said, it wasn't always political, it wasn't always terrorist. Sometimes it's just purely money. But usually people would then want to be diverted somewhere, right? They would take the plane, they'd steal the plane, and be, you can come get it later, right? So they would want to like fly to Cuba, as I said, right?
Yeah.
This was so common that during the golden era of skyjacking, pilots on domestic flights, regardless of where they were flying, they were given extra charts that had maps that showed routes to Havana.
No way.
Yeah. You're flying from St. Louis to Portland, Oregon? Still got a map to go to Havana.
Just in case.
Yeah, because you never know. So that's how it's crazy, right? But the reason why is because there's pretty much zero security.
Yeah.
There was no TSA, no metal detectors for the most part. It was a new technology just starting to be introduced in the 70s. But basically, there was nada. Anyone could walk right up to the gate.
It was a beautiful time, I bet.
Some airports, a person could walk right onto the tarmac without a ticket.
Really?
Because you could get onto the plane and buy the ticket on the plane.
Oh.
So just you could get literally onto the plane without any proof that you had an intent to be
like
on the plane.
Like a train,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah. Exactly. Just like a train. That's exactly the model.
I remember being able to go to the gate to meet people or to bid them adieu.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But
yeah, that existed until 9/11. So
yeah,
that goes all the way up to 2001, basically.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Sky Marshals, which we think of, you know, being a big 9/11 invention, it wasn't. They started in 1970. That's when they actually, but it was because of how many skyjackings there were. And at first they thought, we'll just put a cop on there. Eventually they got to, we need to actually screen the passengers. So like, we gotta have metal detectors. Then we have like the modern era. But at the point, it was so common and so, I don't want to say accepted, but it was a much different approach. They treated it, a hijacking was like kind of like a bank robbery,
mm-hmm.
where the crews, the airline crews, were told by the airlines to act like bank tellers, which is basically avoid any possibility of violence.
Yeah,
do what they say.
Don't be a hero.
Exactly. Yeah. The plane's insured, you know, whatever. Yeah. Go along with their demands. So this basically encouraged a whole culture of skyjacking to emerge, because if you allow it, then you've allowed
it. Well, it's like shoplifting now, where they say don't apprehend the shoplifter.
Yeah.
The people who work in the stores aren't allowed to stop them. And
now you
so,
got a culture.
Now you got a culture of it.
So there's this book called The Skies Belong to Us, and the author's name is Brendan Corner. He documented that between 1968 and 1972, so essentially 5 years, if you count 68 and 72,
mm-hmm.
there were 130 skyjackings just in America.
Wow.
Just in America.
That's a lot.
Yeah, the skies were the Wild West, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So enter my man, Martin McNally, the last of the skyjackers.
Aww.
So he was from Detroit, raised in the suburbs, father owned a shoe store, very all-American upbringing. And his father, because he owns a shoe store, he's a respectable man in McNally's hometown. He and his siblings, there was seven of them in total. They all went to Catholic school, right? Just dad did everything he could to raise good Americans.
Big old literate kids.
Totally. So Martin McNally, he's resistant.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, Dad, you tried. You know, it's like Mama tried. It was like, Papa, you tried. But so natural-born criminal, this guy, Martin McNally, is just in him, right? So by 11th grade, he drops out of high school, drops out of Catholic school, runs off to join the Navy.
Mm.
Smart kid that he is, he gets trained to be an airplane electrician.
Okay.
By 1964, he gets discharged just in time to miss Vietnam War.
Wow, right under the wire on that one.
Gulf of Tonkin, 64. So it's
right.
Like, anyway, his father offers him a spot back at the old family shoe store. And Martin McNally's like, nah, Pop, I'm good. I got the criminal in me. So he goes, stays away from home, and gets caught up in small-time petty crime. He's like, oh, yeah, let me just do my thing.
I mean, so, here he's learned a trade, and he's got to, come on, dude.
Nope, not him. He said he gets a job at a gas station, and there he embezzled gas, just selling it off the books. Obviously, it didn't take him long to get caught.
One cup at a time.
Exactly. Now he'd be like, hey, coming through. Yeah, it's $28, and then he would just keep the $28.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Yeah, embezzlement. So he got caught, and because it was pretty easy bookkeeping on that one. It's like, I've sold 100 gallons. I've got 48 gallons worth of money. What's going on there, Martin? So he eventually gets fired. He moves on to his next gig. His next gig that he comes up for himself is counterfeiting. He's like, what if I just faked the money? All this trying to get the money. What if I just make it?
Big jump.
Right? It is. He was a smart guy, quick thinker. He's like, you know, the problem was, is the money. I'm trying to get money. I could just make that stuff.
Well, he had 11 years of Catholic school under
his
belt.
Exactly. You know. And, you know, and a couple years of Navy engineering school.
That teach you a lot.
Totally. Right, he knows machinery and stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's true.
Anyway, he wasn't better at that. He got caught. Load of counterfeit quarters in his pocket.
Wait, he counterfeited quarters?
Yeah, I left that part out. He was trying to exchange them.
Like his own mint?
You know, he went to the laundromat change machine and was pumping in quarters and trying to get
were
back.
Were they just dummies with nothing printed on them?
I wish I had a better answer
probably
for
just
you.
Slugs?
Yeah, I would imagine it would be, just metal slugs that are about
amazing.
The same weight, same size.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then he's trying to get...
He's just at an arcade.
Nickels for the quarter. And he's like, cool, big score. And he kept doing that.
God.
I don't know, Elizabeth. Anyway, calendar kept flipping pages.
Yeah.
He tries numerous scams, small cons over the years. 1972 rolls around. Everything changes for the man. It was like a light from the heavens shone down on my man, Martin McNally. Instead of the parted clouds, though, making way for a shaft of sunlight, instead his inspiration came from a man in the sky.
Oh.
Yeah. Not like the man in the sky.
Father God.
No, not that. A man wearing a parachute, Elizabeth, clutching a bag of ransom cash as he fell back to Earth. That's what inspired him. Just before Thanksgiving in 1971, the skyjacker, D.B. Cooper, struck. Huge news. All the talk of the nation, even though he hit in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
It was a huge deal, right? One night, 2 months later, Martin McNally's driving around listening to the news on the car radio, right? And he's like looking for his next small-time score. The report is all about the investigation into this mystery man who's commandeered a jet airliner from Portland, a Boeing 727, if you're curious.
Okay.
Skyjacker had demanded that the plane land, and that he be given $200,000 and a parachute. This part is wild to me. You think he'd find a way to bring a parachute with him. Like, if your plan is predicated on the parachute,
right?
Don't you want to have that? There's
have
no x-ray
it in
machine.
And you can have it in your carry-on.
Put it in your carry-on luggage. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't count on the cops to bring me my parachute.
In fact, did he have luggage? It's probably shadier if you don't have any luggage to get on.
No, I think he had a briefcase.
I've done that. Yeah. I've gotten on a plane with nothing.
No, they
definitely
screen
you. And they pull
you
out of the... Yeah.
Especially if it's a one-way flight. I've done that one.
That's what... brother and I, when I bought a car from my uncle, mm-hmm. and we had to fly down and pick it up, and then we were going to drive it back the same day. And
if you bought the ticket the same day, forget about it. You might as well just arrest yourself.
One-way ticket to Vegas.
Yeah, exactly.
No luggage. Yeah. They're like, oh, you too.
Ma'am.
Yeah, we looked a sight, too. So
things were a little different back then.
Yeah.
The cops brought him his parachute. They brought the money. Both legit. They didn't even play any games around,
right? They didn't give him the old slug money inside of all
this
paper. It was
legit money,
all the
$200,000, and a parachute. That works. It wasn't just like forks and spoons inside.
Those were the days, Aaron.
I'm telling you. So the skyjacker orders the pilots to take off again, which they did. 45 minutes later, the skyjacker opens a door, lowers down the stairwell from the back of the jet airliner, climbs down, and he jumped, disappearing into the dark and cloud cover. As the news reported, it seems that he successfully parachuted out of the plane, drifted down through the night sky, and into the forest of the Pacific Northwest, disappearing forever with the $200,000, right? Martin McNally took notes. He's like, okay, I need a gun. I need some fake paperwork.
Basically.
I'll need a disguise. I'll need a parachute. I'll need a plane. It seems simple enough to him. And now he had a new plan for his life.
Yeah.
Air piracy.
Exactly. You got to have a mentor.
Exactly. You just you can see it. You can be it, Elizabeth.
That is so true.
So he would become a skyjacker.
He got like the horn rim glasses. He's like dressed for the job you want.
Exactly. So he gathered up all the necessary materials together, the horn rim glasses, the gun, and then he... To get do this, because it was a pretty good list. It'd be like if you were doing it, and he's like, okay, it was like a 17-point list.
Yeah.
He hits up a guy he knew in the underground, right? This guy, Walter Petlikowski. He's a local pool hustler. Also, he dealt guns on the
he's
side.
He's in the underground. He's a mole man.
Yeah, exactly. He's in the underworld, right? So McNally, he bought a .45 rifle from the pool hustler.
Okay.
Then he customized it. He sawed off the barrel. 10 full inches he cuts off, right? He cuts it down like Steve McQueen's mare's leg on the old TV show Wanted Dead or Alive.
Yeah.
So basically, just imagine like a quarter inch of barrel sticking out of the wood.
Just a little pew pew.
Exactly. So satisfied with Petlikowski's value as a small-time criminal, McNally's like, hey man, you want to be my accomplice? I'll cut you in for $50,000.
What does it do to cut the barrel off like that?
For him, it was the length he wanted to be able to secret it away somewhere.
I see. Like put it in his pant leg or something.
And so and with Steve McQueen, he wanted to be able to carry it on his leg when he was riding a horse and then quickly draw it. And then it reduces your accuracy by a lot, but it essentially becomes like a shotgun.
But why wouldn't you just carry a pistol?
Because you want the stopping power that it offers.
Oh, okay. See, I'm learning.
Yeah.
I'm learning today.
Also, in the UK... Here, we call it a sawed-off shotgun if it's a shotgun.
Yeah.
The UK, they call it a sawn-off shotgun.
Yes.
Oh,
Interesting. Past tense.
Yeah, sawn-off. Well, the thing, too, it's like you got to have the pistol for close-up work.
Yes, exactly.
Use the pistol to get to your long gun.
Yeah.
I know you do all your wet work with a blade. But...
I am. I live and die by the blade. Yeah,
so I know you're studying the blade with the rest of us.
I was studying the blade.
So McNally, he finds a briefcase that will house his nude sawn-off 45 rifle. That's for you, Producer D. And also he shoves into this briefcase a wig and some smoke bombs.
Hell he's like, yeah, good with to a go. Wig.
Next, he also had to find the perfect airport to hit for the next few months. He cases airports. He goes to Kansas City. He goes to Chicago. Goes to Indianapolis. Finally decides St. Louis. That's the spot. Because of this place, Lambert Airport in St. Louis, they had the worst security of all of the Midwest airports.
Good to know.
So he took his accomplice, Putlikowski, to the airport. They did a couple trial runs. Everything went smoothly. The two men knew it was time to fly.
Yeah.
Let's take a break, Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
After this, we'll be back to take to the skies.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Springtime is all about fresh air and fresh starts. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security. It's the only home security system I use and recommend. Here's why I love it. With the days getting longer and the weather warming up, we're out and about a lot more. And that applies to criminals, too. I don't have to worry because SimpliSafe blankets my whole home in protection. It has sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. And there are indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over my property day and night. It's not just cameras. SimpliSafe has professional monitoring agents who keep watch on your home when you aren't there. Agents can stop crime in real time by speaking to intruders through the wireless indoor camera, warning them that they're being recorded and the police are on their way. Sounds great, right? There's no contract, and they offer a 60-day money-back guarantee. So trying SimpliSafe is risk-free. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/ridiculouscrime. That's simplisafe.com/ridiculouscrime. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Elizabeth.
You know, when you were, when I said big old jet airliner, yes. And you said
Bingo Jet had a light on.
Yeah. That's how you always hear the Steve Miller lyrics. Totally. And then now I can't ever hear them in another way.
You're
and
welcome.
That's why I liked to bring
Bingo
that up.
Jet is a folk hero. Just Bingo know that jet. Much.
Bingo Jet is like, I just imagine is kind of like a Country Bears jamboree looking thing with like a stovepipe hat.
If he didn't have his light on, do you know how many people would be lost in the dark?
Thank you, Bingo Jet.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Elizabeth, you ready to skyjack a jumbo jet airliner?
If my name ain't Bingo Jet.
So June 23rd.
Yeah.
It was a Friday.
Okay.
It was also the day that McNally and his wheelman, Putlikowski, decided it's go time.
Yeah.
So the two men, they drove over to the St. Louis airport. McNally gets dropped off at the main terminal. He has his briefcase with him. Inside, loaded up, is a sawed-off 45 rifle, the smoke bombs, no wig. Not yet.
Darn it.
Yeah, I know. He waved goodbye to his wheelman, headed inside the airport, went to the ticket counter, bought a one-way ticket to Tulsa, Oklahoma.
St. Louis to Tulsa.
Yeah. He told the lady behind the ticket counter his name was Robert Wilson. Now, I don't know if that's like a whole play on Robert Anton Wilson or not, but anyway, Robert Wilson.
Bob, to pay for his friends.
Yeah, pay for the ticket. He showed his Navy discharge papers, but the documents were forged. Mm. They were good for one airline ticket home, because when you're discharged from the military, airlines will,
if you just show your discharge paper,
they'll fly you home.
Okay.
So he knew that, and he's like, fly me home. On the way to the plane, no metal detectors to pass through.
Yeah.
It's a new technology. It has not been installed in St. Louis, right?
Well, and they're like, hey, thank you for your service. Get on this
exactly,
plane.
Exactly, sir.
Yeah,
come
they're
on.
Not going to look twice.
He gives his ticket, boards the plane, takes his seat three rows from the rear of the plane. He calmly enjoys the flight. Oh, look at this, above the clouds.
Carving
amazing.
Station.
Exactly. So, no, I'll have the oysters, thank you. About a half hour before the flight was set to land in Tulsa, he gets up, goes to the bathroom, wants to freshen up, takes his briefcase with him. He pulls out his brown, shaggy wig, makes him look kind of like
yes.
a hippie, slid on a pair of sunglasses, aviators, his disguise now complete. He pulled out his sawed-off rifle, stepped out of the laboratory, walks up to the flight attendant, hands her a note. Flight attendant looks down at the note, the rifle goes, oh, Lord, takes the note to the cockpit. Few tense minutes now pass.
Why?
Right?
Why wouldn't he wear the wig the whole time? Because everyone's seen him.
Exactly.
The person sitting next to him is like this clean cut. And then he comes back as like Jimmy Shag-a-Lot.
I think
like,
he's hoping that he'd be not memorable up to that point. And then once he has the gun, people are paying attention. And they're like, I don't remember. There was some guy, maybe.
Well, that's an interesting.
Right? I don't know. That's how I read it. But
okay.
I don't know. So McNally, he's sitting there now, waiting in his seat with the wig on, the glasses, the gun. And he's sitting there going, what's she telling the pilots, right? Minutes go by. And he's like, and all of a sudden, he hears the pilot on the plane's intercom. He's like, ladies and gentlemen, we have a passenger who needs to return to St. Louis, so we're going to be returning. Based on all the details he could pull from the newspaper accounts, McNally had followed D.B. Cooper's skyjacking to the jot and tittle. He had upped the ransom amount, though. That's the big difference.
Okay.
Everything else is exactly what D.B. Cooper had done.
Yeah.
Right down to the note, right?
Well, it's a cola. You know, cost of living increase.
Exactly. McNally, he had upped it to $500,000.
Oh,
yeah,
hello.
A little more than a cola. But anyway, he had one other request. He wanted $2,000 in small bills.
Oh, I want to make it rain.
What was he? Exactly. Good call. He planned to tip the flight attendants.
Oh, how good of him.
Right?
You got it. You got to juice people out when you're doing these things.
I am a big fan of tipping.
Me
except
too.
For what they've done lately.
Oh, my God.
Where now I got to like tip the guy at the weed store.
That is true. They do
I'm like,
that.
Dude, you hit buttons. You hit three more buttons than I did.
Yeah.
And I got to give you 10, like 7%
well,
of my sales.
And like you go to a bakery counter and they just hand it to you. And then all of a sudden they flip that screen around
yeah.
and then the pressure's on.
I'm
and
like,
I want everyone to like me.
Totally. I know you're bad about
that's
you.
All I care about. And so when they're staring at me, I'm like...
The bakery, they did something. They baked the baked goods.
That person
the weed
didn't.
Store didn't do anything other than show up.
Then maybe they grew it.
No, they don't do anything.
Well,
okay, they do some warehousing and some
right.
like putting it on the shelves.
But like
shelves.
People who do stuff, like when you stay in a hotel, you have got to leave a tip
always,
for housekeeping.
Yes, I'm a big believer in
must
this.
Must do it.
But now we're changing tip culture. We're allowing, I don't think people are going to be tipping the way they should
that's
because
what
they're
I worry
gonna get,
about.
They're going to become inured to it because they're being asked all the time.
That's what I worry about. You got to duke the people who need it.
Exactly.
You know, and everyone else, like you just ring me up as a cashier somewhere. I'm sorry for your troubles. I've had that job. It's terrible, but like
totally.
No one tipped me out.
I worked plenty of customer service where
mm-hmm.
tips like, you know, barista jobs and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Done that. I appreciated the tips. I tip baristas all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, me too.
But they're once again doing something. There is a service. The weed guy, they didn't do anything.
You really hung up on the weed.
I'm sorry.
Well, especially because when they flip that thing around and it's like
yes!
18%, you're like,
on
that's
$400? I'm like, what are you talking about here? I'm not buying you a car tire.
Here, you move weight at the weed store,
I buy too.
Too
much. So anyway, so the pilots, they decide to do as instructed because, you know, they got the note. It's very clear. They turn around. They land the plane
I
in
like
St.
How,
Louis.
How current and up to date are like, let's talk tipping culture. That's a little, you know, just a little juicy
yeah.
current events on the side
just
there.
Just trying to, you know, sidetrack a little here for
it
you.
It feels cool. It feels like a morning show.
A little morning zoo action. So at this point, in our story, right? We have, it's about 4 p.m. on Friday afternoon,
mm-hmm.
right? The airport is getting busy at this point, and now there's a hijacked plane far into the airfield clogging up everything. McNally tells the airlines that he has a bomb on board the plane and that any attempts to storm the plane will result in a huge explosion and
oh,
a major
God.
Loss of life, right? The negotiations with the airlines, it lasts for for an hour. FBI gets called in. Flight attendants are taking McNally's demands to the cockpit. The pilots convey his latest demands to the tower. The tower then calls back with any updates. Then they give the note to the attendant. She walks back down the aisle to the back of the plane.
Can you imagine?
Every single exchange is like this.
You're next to him.
Yes.
Your seat is next to him. Can you imagine that?
No.
Because you're overhearing all the back and forth. Like, the rest of the plane probably doesn't know about this. Mm-hmm. Well, he says he has a bomb.
I don't think he'd have a bomb unless he seemed political.
No. Like, but if he tells them ransom, he has a bomb, and I'm sitting next to him and I hear him say, the rest of the plane probably doesn't know that.
I wouldn't believe him.
I don't know. I'd get scared.
If you seem political,
everything
I would.
Scares
but
me.
But if he's like a ransom guy, I'm like, I don't believe you. You're not going to blow yourself up for
I'd
me.
Be like, he looks shady. He looks like a hippie. He's got wig. He's
I'd have
got
to call
bomb.
That bluff. And then I feel bad for everybody else if I was wrong. So I wouldn't do anything. I would act normal for everybody else's benefit. But if I was alone on that plane, I'm calling the bluff. Anyway, so they have the negotiators going back and forth. The FBI is now involved, right? The flight attendants are running the messages. And after an hour of this, McNally shows that he will be considerate. He will be kind. He doesn't, basically an act of kindness, Elizabeth. He shows that he is a good faith negotiator. Mm-hmm. He lets 80 passengers off the plane.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's really nice of him. It's the vast majority of the people on the plane.
Yeah, they're like, who has to pee the worst?
Yes, everybody. He only keeps a small handful, right?
The children.
Just the kids.
They're like, man, he is bad.
Yeah, he's a bad man. So the FBI agent to this point, they tell the skyjacker, hey, man, we're working on your money. But at this point, it's like past banker's hours. It's past 5 p.m. on a Friday. $500,000 is going to be hard to go and gather. Mm-hmm. So McNally's like, I don't know. I call hijinks. They're like, oh, man, come on. He's like, oh, nope, plane. Pilots take off. We're leaving. So he makes them fly away. So he's convinced now, while he's still negotiating with the tower, that they can go and get the money in Dallas-Fort Worth. He's like, I got like a time difference.
We got more money
so
down
I'm going
to
fly and pick up a little time, and you guys work on it. And they're like, okay, yeah, we think we can do that. Then McNally, they cannot raise the money in Dallas fast enough. So he's like, oh, wait, go back to St. Louis. And now the plane flies back, lands again in St. Louis.
He wants that Budweiser money.
Exactly. Good AB money. So it's 9 p.m. on a Friday night at this point. Plane touches back down in St. Louis. McNally informs the FBI agents, I have new demands. He wants not one, not two, but 5 parachutes. He also wants a good shovel. Not one of them BS shovels. I want a good shovel.
Yeah.
And a pair of flight goggles like I've seen in the movies, right? The FBI is like, okay, give us time. So it turns out the FBI agents, they weren't stalling. They legitimately went out and located a good shovel, a pair of flight goggles, the whole thing, right? The money finally arrived. So now they got the $500,000. They put in a heavy canvas airmail bag, and they put in the $2,000 in cash, like in an envelope, a little separate parcel for him. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, you know, everything's golden on this. Okay, cool. But he's like, wait, I got one more demand. They're like, oh my God, are you for real? What do you want? Are you hungry? And he's like, no. I need someone to show me how to put on a parachute. So send on a parachute guy.
Are you? He's asked for 5 of them. Is he like me? He's like, well, if one's good, 5's better.
Pretty much. So the FBI is like, here's our chance. So they send an FBI field agent onto the plane as a parachute instructor, right? And McNally, though, he's ready for him. So he stays at the back of the plane with his like mare's leg 45 aimed down the aisle. And he's like, show me down there. And the guy's like, oh, okay. The FBI guy basically shows him how to put on a parachute from a comfortable distance. He gets all strapped in. He's like, all right, cool. Cool, get off the plane now. And so the FBI guy has to get off the plane. No funny business, right?
Why didn't he say something like, well, this actually takes 2 people to do, or you have
something.
To...
Midnight. Come on. We're now at midnight. McNally, he lets 13 more hostages off the plane. They're like, hey, I gotta go to the bathroom. My back hurts, right? He's like, oh, of course. I'm not a jerk, right? He keeps just one hostage.
Oh, that poor person.
The 2 flight attendants, then the 2 pilots and the navigator, right? So the air crew, the attendant, flight attendants, and 1 hostage. What's up with that 1 hostage? Were they just a jerk? Were they a good conversationalist? They had good stories? He's like, I like this guy. Or is it, I hate this guy?
Yeah,
which is
one?
It?
Yeah.
But they kept the 1, right? So at this point, the skyjacking is national news.
Yeah.
Inside the airport, people are watching what's happening on the tarmac on the news.
Right.
So there's the knock. Right. Eventually, one guy, this dude named David Hanley, he's like, I'm going to go be the hero.
Oh.
Hanley strolls over to his 1971 Cadillac Eldorado, fires that bad boy to life. Meanwhile, at this same point, McNally's jet has now been refueled. He's received his ransom money. He's been shown how a parachute works. He's ordered the pilots to take back off. Now, there's nothing that can stop him, right? Except for perhaps a Cadillac.
Right.
So Hanley aims his Cadillac at the gate to the tarmac, punches it, boom, this pride of the Detroit assembly line gets up to about 80 miles an hour and goes right through that gate like a wrecking ball. Boom, fence flies open. Plane is now on the tarmac, headed for the runway, taxiing for its takeoff. David Hanley sees this. He's careening his caddy across the tarmac, avoiding like baggage handlers, punches it again, floors it to try to catch up to the plane, which is now on the runway taxiing.
Are you kidding?
Heading down for the sky, right? Captain of the hijacked plane sees the Cadillac headed right for him, directly at him. He's playing chicken now with a Cadillac Eldorado. He shouts over the plane's intercom to the skyjacker, "Oh my God, there's a vehicle on the runway." Hanley braces for impact inside the Cadillac because he's about to hit a Boeing 727.
Oh my God.
The pilot braces for the impact because he's about to get hit by a Cadillac. So the Cadillac slams into the landing gear of the plane. The nose wheel takes the full brunt of the Cadillac.
Yeah.
Inside the plane, McNally gets thrown forward. Underneath the plane, the Cadillac caroms off the that first landing gear and then crashes into the port side wing's landing gear. Hits the other landing gear. Goes boom, boom. Plane now slows to a stop. The Cadillac is wedged up against the landing gear. Luckily for everyone involved, the fully loaded jet with jet fuel did not explode. That was the one good thing that happened. McNally yells, "Get me another plane."
Oh my God.
So while he and the hostages wait inside the plane, the ambulance comes out onto the runway, extricates David Hanley from his now wrecked Cadillac Eldorado.
And who is he? Like,
just a random guy.
Just a civilian.
I'm going to be the hero.
Oh my, what in the,
He broke multiple ribs, had a fractured skull, broke his jaw in two places. He had a broken left arm and a broken left ankle.
Oh,
a year later, the Associated Press, they found David Hanley. They're like, "Man, Elizabeth Dutton in the future would like to know, what were you thinking?"
Yeah.
And I have an answer for you. And they're like, "Man, because were you drunk? What was going on?"
Yeah.
Hanley tells the AP reporter, "My mind is a blank from 6 o'clock that night to 2 weeks later." So the AP then, okay, well, you know, there's been reports about what went on. And they, you know, the reports are you spent Friday afternoon at a cocktail lounge near the airport watching the news. In fact, you told your drinking friends in the bar that you were about to, quote, go shock the world. Hanley said, "It never happened." And he said, and I quote, "If I was there, then any friends who were with me were a bunch of slucks. No one has come to me and said, 'David, I was with you that night. This is what you said.'" I have never heard the term slucks.
I was just going to say sluck.
I looked it up. Could not find a definition. Except for in Scots. In Scots, it's a word. It means to gulp noisily, like slurping with gulps.
Yeah.
So I that kind of makes sense in this context. So basically, slucks are a bunch of loud gulpers.
I think he's been mishearing schmucks his whole life.
That could be it.
And he just, or they mistyped it in the transcription.
A bunch of sucks? I don't know.
Yeah.
Slicks?
Wow.
Slacks? I don't know. I thought about the typo, but.
I can just see this, though, of him at an airport.
Cocktail
an
bar.
Airport adjacent.
Adjacent cocktail lounge, yeah.
Oh my God.
So 90 minutes after this, the St. Louis airport had a new plane ready for McNally to hijack.
Are there no possible moments where they could just pick this dude off from a sniper tower?
He has to now get off the plane and get on the new
plane. That's what I'm saying.
You have exactly your moment, Elizabeth.
I mean,
you just jumped the gun.
I feel like they've already had like four moments where I could have totally
gone through the window,
like stopped this whole thing.
Well,
in
you
its could've. Tracks.
You're reasonable. So the Boeing 727, the new one, gets loaded up gas, pulled up on the tarmac. Now McNally has to get from one plane to the other without being picked off by snipers. So he's like, "Future Elizabeth Dutton, I'd like you to know my plan." His plan was, "I'm going to sandwich myself between these two flight attendants, put the briefcase on my head, and move real quick." And that's what he did. He shuttled himself, boarded the second plane, got the flight crew on board with his one civilian hostage, and then said, "We ride."
So,
and so, boom.
According to them, though, he said there was a bomb on the original plane.
Yeah, exactly.
So now he doesn't have that leverage.
He's still got his briefcase.
Oh, he thinks it's in the briefcase.
He's got to be bluffing that it's in the briefcase.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so now that they're on the second plane, McNally ordered the pilot to take off and to head to Toronto. Coincidentally, that flight path would take him over his old hometown of Detroit, which is all part of his plan. So he'd done all the necessary calculations on paper. He'd worked out when he'd need to jump out of a plane and what airspeed. So that his parachute wouldn't be torn to tatters by the wind shear forces. So at 4 a.m., McNally has now readied himself for his jump. He's pulled off his hippie wig and his sunglasses. He's strapped on his parachute harness. The plane is cruising at an altitude of about 10,000 feet.
Uh-huh.
Just above the low, thick white clouds that night. McNally, he can't see the ground, right? There's a problem with this because there's a big thing called Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
He does not want to land in the middle of Lake Michigan with a parachute.
Right.
That would be death, right? So he's like, okay, I'll probably be, well, basically, he's going to jump early. I'll just cut right to it, Elizabeth. Uh-huh. The dude's going to jump early. So the plane at this point is still over Indiana when he decided it was time to bail. He took up his money bag and his shovel. And when he landed, his plan was that he would bury the money and then come back for it later. So he needs a shovel,
right? I totally
right?
forgot about the shovel. Yeah, exactly. So he was running across the tarmac with a shovel.
With a shovel, too, yeah, in one hand.
Or he probably the made briefcase, one of the ladies gun. Carry it.
Yeah, probably, maybe the one of them. So he waddles to the back of the plane. He opens the door, lowers the stairwell, just like D.B. Cooper did. He scoots down the stairway, his butt hitting on each step, right? He's been on the plane at this point, or one plane or another, for 11 hours. He's got to be starving.
Yeah.
And despite the nut job and the Cadillac playing chicken with the first plane,
so good.
He's now managed to get his $500,000 and to get away with it all, right? He's 28 years old, small-time criminal. All he has left to do is to just step off and jump into the sky.
Wow.
He tossed his wig through the open door. It whipped away. Gone, right? He threw the rest of his disguise clothes out of the open door. Whew. He tossed out his rifle, his smoke bombs. Now he's unarmed. The single hostage watching McNally take his canvas bag with the $500,000. He's sitting there. He's got to be wondering, is this boy going to jump or not?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the boy, you know, McNally, he's got to be wondering, am I going to jump
right.
or not? And then suddenly the dude gets his answer. Mark McNally stepped out into the sky and disappeared. He was about 10,000 feet above the earth, traveling at a few hundred miles an hour now, about 300 miles,
oh
the same
God.
Speed the plane that he just
yeah.
left was going. All he needed to do was successfully land. Elizabeth, we'll take a little break. And after this, I will tell you if he lands or not.
Oh, boy.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in
exactly.
to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, right. which is different than empathy,
yeah.
right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already yeah. see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together. We'll cry together and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi.
You want to hear the rest of the story?
After those ads, yeah, I do.
So, something I forgot to tell you about all of this. Martin McNally, who's about to jump off into the sky, actually, you know, I just said he did.
Mm-hmm.
This is his first jump ever with a parachute. He's never touched a parachute prior to this. All of
what?
Everything he did was on, paper calculations.
He had to ask that man to show him how to put a parachute
on. Totally. But, you know, like, it wasn't like he was in the military and he's like, oh, these are newer than the ones we had. He's never jumped out of a plane.
Oh, God.
So what do you think happened? Do you think he made it?
Because he was in prison with the other guy.
Oh, right. Good one. You skipped.
Otherwise,
okay.
I'd be like, well, he's a hole in the ground somewhere.
He's a pancake. Well, I'll answer the question fully, Elizabeth. But to do that, I'd like you to close your eyes.
My eyes are closed.
And I'd like you to picture it. Elizabeth, you are aboard a Boeing 727. The rear door is open. Wind whips through the cabin. The sound of the jets hum and throb in the turbulent air. At the moment, some lunatic is on the rear stairway holding onto the plane by his hands as his body flaps in the wind generated by the plane's airspeed. He's going about 300 miles an hour. Unfortunately, you are the unlucky spider that decided to take a nap in a canvas airmail bag, which is then later turned into a money bag for the lunatic skyjacker. Now, you are still in that same canvas airmail bag, the one that's currently strapped to the aforementioned lunatic. What you don't know is there's a military surveillance plane shadowing the Boeing 727 from above. The FBI agents are also watching this skyjacker to see his next move. That is, if he'll jump. You know the answer to that before they do. He does. He lets go of the plane. You and the canvas airmail bag go with him. Suddenly, it's silent. Well, not exactly silent. There's the rush of wind as you and the lunatic skyjacker plummet to Earth. You hear Martin McNally whimper as the flight goggles are crushed against his eye holes from the air pressure and the sheer of the wind speed. Then he kind of yelps when the flight goggles are pulled clean off his head. You can feel his heartbeat through the thick canvas airmail bag. He seems to be panicking. He lets one arm up from his body, perhaps to gain some sense of direction. It has the opposite effect. He starts to spin. Violently, you and he get whipped around. You in the canvas airmail bag, him in the wind. You have to climb up towards the opening to keep from getting crushed by the $500,000 in cash. Meanwhile, McNally is mentally calculating how long he's been in the air and if he's reached terminal velocity. That was based on calculations he did earlier at home, but now he's in the sky and his math ain't mathin'. He knows he can't pull the ripcord too early or the wind shear will tear those silk to ribbons and he'll plummet and land in a painful splat. But he'd have to pull the ripcord eventually. You can hear him counting out loud the seconds as they tick past. And then he rips the cord. But he never pulled his arm back into center mass. When the parachute unfurls from the chest harness, it slams into McNally's face as he starts to spin. The parachute also comes out with so much force, he's momentarily dazed. He quickly recovers. You hear him desperately grabbing at tether ropes, twisting above him. Somehow, he manages to yank on the correct ones in a way that the parachute fills with air and the canopy opens. He and the chute slow down their descent. But the sudden yank of the parachute and the abrupt change in falling speed separates the canvas airmail bag from McNally. You've climbed to the top of the bag. You look up and you see the man in the parachute above you. McNally looks down at you, and the canvas airmail bag grows smaller and smaller as you plummet to the earth. You can barely see the white canopy of the parachute anymore. Wind is rushing past you. It's getting smaller and smaller in the sky. You and the $500,000 are on your own now. And then you and the canvas airmail bag slam into soft soil. You've landed in a bean field, and you're unharmed, Elizabeth. Way to go, spider.
All right.
And you're $500,000 richer. If you could find someone to help you move this canvas bag of cash. All right, Elizabeth. So
yes.
Money hits. McNally, where did he land? Totally different bean field.
The Milagro bean field.
Yeah, exactly. There's a little war going on over there. With a much softer landing, though, he hits, and boom, he landed safely back on solid ground. The idiot did it. I can't believe it, right? He jumped out of a plane, first time ever, manages to get back without dying, but he dropped the money. The whole reason why he did all of this. After the two planes, the crash caddy, the FBI snipers, he beats it all, and then he drops the money.
And there's really no way it's going to be difficult, if impossible, to figure out where it landed for him on his perspective.
Oh, because not only did he drop the money, he also knocked himself out when his head slammed into the hard earth when he landed.
Oh, no.
So he's just unconscious lying there in a field.
Oh, God.
Eventually he comes to, right? No money, no hope, no job.
And this is like 4 a.m, right?
Yes, of course. I mean, he's got basically concussion stars dancing in his eyes.
Yeah.
That's the only wealth he sees. And all he has on him in his pockets is $300. That's what he walked onto the plane with. So he can hear dogs barking in the distance, and he realizes he's in a farmer's field. The sun's going to be coming up soon. He's going to need to get himself gone, right? So he pulls himself to his feet, gathers up his parachute like he's a World War II bomber pilot who's just been shot down in enemy territory.
Yeah.
He's grabbing it all together. He trudges across the muddy field, climbs over a barbed wire fence. His body at this point is now giving out on him, right?
Yeah.
He lays the parachute out and then lays down atop it and takes a long nap.
He probably has a concussion.
Totally. I mean, he's knocked himself silly, right? A couple hours later, he comes to. The birds now, a little bit after dawn, have begun to sound. He awakes to sun on his face. He knows that his white silk parachute will be spotted in the daylight.
Yeah.
So he gathers it up again, buries it in the nearby woods under a pile of leaves and a bunch of branches. And then he climbs back inside his new, now makeshift sleeping bag, and he sleeps for another 6 hours or so.
Oh, wow.
Definite concussion. So.
Yeah.
Next time he wakes up, it's due to the sound of a helicopter overhead. He hears hound dogs in the distance. Obviously, there is a search party, and they are close.
Yeah.
McNally decided his best option, I'm going to lay low. I'm going to hope that the dogs don't detect me. He lays there in the leaf-covered parachute sleeping bag and just prays, I guess. I don't know if he prayed, but he's just sitting there by himself. Darkness returns to the land, Elizabeth. McNally comes out of his hiding spot. Pulls up his parachute, buries it in the earth for good this time, cleans himself up, walks back into civilization.
The hounds didn't get him.
No, they didn't find him.
Interesting.
In the long distance, he spies a glow of lights, right? Maybe it's a small Midwestern city. He still doesn't know where he is.
Yeah.
So he comes to a two-lane road, and he follows that, headed toward the glow of lights in the distance. Cars are passing him by, trucks. They all seem to have Indiana license plates. So he's like, okay, it must be Indiana.
Yeah.
Finally, a car pulls over, stops. The driver asks, oh, do you need a ride? McNally's like worn out. He's beaten up. He's like, yeah, I can use a ride. Thank you. He climbs in. The driver is the chief of police of Peru, Indiana.
Oh, stop it.
With his wife.
Oh, that's too good.
The police chief's name is Richard Blair, right?
And he has to know that something's gone.
He knows all about the manhunt. He's just, that's what he's been doing all day. So he and his wife are on their way home, but they see this young man out alone. And the wife's like, oh, honey, we should pick him up. And the cop's like, yeah, we should. So McNally, he's got forged documents on him, right? So he shows them to the chief of the police, right? And interestingly, I don't know why, he forged his Michigan driver's license with his brother's name, Patrick McNally.
Oh.
He didn't change, just Patrick McNally, right? So police chief, he asked, what's this guy, young man, doing on a farm road alone late at night?
Yeah.
Had he been in an accident? Was there something going on? McNally's like, oh no, I was with my brother earlier and, you know, we got dumb drunk and then, you know how it is, we got into a fight, my brother drove off all angry and I walked in the other direction, I don't know where I am. The cop's like, okay, well, I can give you a ride to Peru. And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, that's on my way home. He's like, oh, thanks, man. That's great, right? Cop, I don't know how much he believes it, right? But McNally, he manages to get all the way into town, right? The police chief must have been pretty suspicious because, as I told you, there is the manhunt. He was part of it. He'd ask McNally, had he heard about it? He's like, hey, have you heard about this? We got a big manhunt right now. The skyjacker jumped out of a plane. And McNally's like, oh, man, that'd be great. Couldn't you believe it? I would have loved to find the skyjacker's bag of money.
Oh, God.
So Chief Blair, he's like, okay, kid. He drops McNally off of at a motel in Peru, Indiana. The motel is right across the street from police headquarters. He's like, I'll just keep an eye on you.
Yeah, exactly.
So McNally checks in, gets a room. Motel clerk gives him the once over. It says, you aren't the skyjacker, are you?
Oh, no.
McNally jokes the question away again. He's like, no, but I sure wish I was, right? And he's like, I bet that guy's far away by now. And motel clerk, she seems satisfied.
I wish I had that bag of money with unique markings on it.
Now he asks, like, hey, there's a local diner around here. I am starving. So he walks over, gets himself a burger, right? Peru, Indiana, not a big town.
Yeah.
So as we've covered before, small town folks, a little suspicious, a little bit curious.
Sure.
The locals in Peru, Indiana, no different. They gave McNally the hard eye stare the entire meal, right?
Yeah.
After he eats, he gets up. He's like, okay, everyone's like.
Well, and does he have like two black eyes?
Oh, yeah,
from
he's
where
beaten
the,
up. Oh,
yeah.
He's all kinds of beaten up, right?
Because the goggles and all that,
He's got all cuts, scrapes. So he's trying to lay low back at the hotel room, but his mind is racing, right? So he calls. He's like, oh, I wonder what's up with my accomplice, Petlikowski. I wonder what he's doing. He's got to be freaking out. Oh, I wonder if he's double-crossed me, right? Because he's he's wondering if Pat Lukowski thinks he's screwed him out of his cut. Yeah. And then he's going to go and get his revenge by flipping on him.
Yeah.
So he goes to a payphone. He calls Pat Lukowski. No answer. Then he has to go back to his hotel room. He turns on the motel TV. The police at this point have released a sketch of the skyjacker. It's a man with sunglasses, aviator sunglasses, and a mop of shaggy hair like a hippie.
Oh, so, yeah, it did work.
It didn't look much like McNally. So he's feeling a little relaxed at this point. The next day, he goes back to the payphone. He calls his accomplice again. Nothing, right? The motel at this point is crawling with FBI agents because they've also booked rooms in the exact same hotel across the street from the police station.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so they're all there at the Peru Motor Lodge together. So he walks back into his payphone again, see if he can call Pat Lukowski. He's got to pass FBI agents, and they're all giving him the stink eye.
Sure.
He's trying to play it cool. He makes it to the phone again. He calls again. No answer. He's like, Next day, he has to do it all over again. He's got to go past all the FBI field agents. He's trying to play it cool. He gets it. He calls his accomplice. This time, Pat Lukowski picks up. The guy says, oh, hey, man, I thought you were dead. Elizabeth, all my life, I've wanted a small-time criminal to tell me, I thought you were dead. It'd be just like a dream, you know? Anyway, he lived my dream. The accomplice tells the man, I got bad news for you, McNally. The cops, they found the money bag. He's like, damn, right? It landed in a bean field not too far from where he hit. And the old bean farmer went out that morning, finds it. He sees the bag and he goes and he does the right thing. He calls into the police. And by the right thing, I, of course, mean the wrong thing. He calls into the police and reports the money. $500,000. You know that is at the time, the Guinness Book World Record for the most money ever turned in by a good Samaritan. I'm not even joking. It was in the book. Yes. So the accomplice, Pat Lukowski, he hightails it to Peru because he's like, we need to get you out of there.
Yeah.
The cops and the FBI agents, they're still all over Peru because McNally's sawed-off rifle was found where he had stashed it when the cop came and picked him up.
Right.
He kind of ditched his rifle at that point.
Oh.
And so the cops find it. And they're like, he's got to be pretty close.
Yeah.
Pat Lukowski manages to get into town, safely grab McNally, retrieve him without any FBI agents stopping them. They make it out of town.
You're
unbelievable.
Kidding me.
Yes. And then they get back to Detroit. The FBI is waiting at McNally's house. He was a person of interest. His Robert Wilson discharge papers were easily connected to him because all he forged was the name. Everything else had all the identifying details.
Address.
So they just went to the naval records. They're like, who's this guy? And also, not only that, two small-time crooks in Detroit who he had told about his plan flipped on him for the reward money.
Why
instantly.
Did he tell them?
Because he's a dummy.
Yeah.
So McNally gets arrested right outside of his house. He doesn't even get a step inside like a shower.
Yeah.
So he gets charged with air piracy, which at that time was punishable by death.
Really?
Like it was the Navy, like the British Navy came up with the law. It was like, we're going to kill you.
It's piracy. When you use the word piracy.
I know. But air piracy was punishable by death. So McNally, he gets lucky on that score because just before he goes to trial, the Supreme Court issued a moratorium on the death penalty.
Oh.
And he's, of course, like saved by that. So his trial's speedy, just like the Constitution would have wanted.
Yeah.
He's found guilty, sentenced to 30 years in federal prison. As soon as he's inside, he starts looking for a way to escape. And this is where things get wild, because in Leavenworth Prison, he meets fellow skyjacker Garrett Brock Trapnell.
Oh, my God.
He was the one who, as I told you, snuck onto a plane with a fake arm cast, tried to hijack a plane. The FBI stormed the plane. He gets caught, right? Now, if you remember from his story, as I told you, he planned to escape with his girlfriend, who's on the outside. Well, he and McNally got along like two bugs in a rug, so he's like, you should be part of my skyjacker pact. Let's do this.
Totally.
McNally said, and I quote, at one point, we made a commitment to each other. If I ever got out, I would skyjack a plane to get him out, or he would skyjack a plane to get me out. They're skyjacker brothers.
So skyjacker brothers.
So the two men, they get separated for a couple years, right, as they're shuffled through the federal prison system. They both wind up, though, in Marion, Illinois, when the federal prison system, they introduced the new Supermax prisons.
Oh,
so
right.
they start putting all the guys there. These two skyjackers, they end up on the same cell block. Hey, Zig McNally! Hey, Trapnell!
The Jacker brothers.
Exactly. So it doesn't take them long to cook up their escape plan. Trapnell comes up with the method. He asks McNally, and I quote, how would you like to leave this place in a helicopter? And obviously, he's down for antics in the skies.
Sure.
And he's like, bet. So Garrett Brock Trapnell convinced his former Army Staff Sergeant girlfriend, Barbara Oswald, to hijack a helicopter, force the pilot to fly them to prison, then pick up the guys and fly them all to safety. She had fallen in love with Garrett Brock Trapnell after she read his jailhouse memoir, The Fox is Crazy Too, the true story of Garrett Trapnell, adventurer, skyjacker, bank robber, con man, lover.
There's no need to even try and shop your book.
I'm telling Yeah, you cannot just compete with these. Time. Just do time, and you immediately got a book deal.
Exactly.
And you might even get a partner out of it, apparently.
Hey, who knows?
So after reading it, she wrote to Trapnell, and the two struck up a relationship. She promised that she would help him escape, and together they would leave America and move to his 2,000-acre plantation that he told her he owned in Australia.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Elizabeth, there was no plantation in Australia. That's what we in the imaginary real estate industry call a lie. So the real plan was Oswald would hijack a helicopter, break them out, then Trapnell and McNally would ditch her and start robbing banks until they had enough money to go on the run and flee America together, like Butch and Sundance.
Jacker Bros.
Jacker Bros, exactly. So on May 24th, 1978, McNally and Trapnell and another inmate, they're stalling for time in the prison yard because they know that the chopper should be coming in soon and waiting for Barbara Oswald, right? McNally is the one to spot the chopper on its approach to the prison. It's like a Vietnam movie. Okay, the chopper's totally on the distance. Light up the LZ, right?
And then like either the Rolling Stones or the Supremes starts playing.
So he signals to Trapnell, it's time to go, right? The chopper's getting closer and closer. The rotors begin to beat the air. Everyone can hear it now. Then it starts to kick up the loose dust and the dirt on the prison yard. The guards, they're rushing around. They know this is a prison break. They start grabbing weapons. They're aiming them at the sky. It is obvious to everybody what's happening. McNally, Trapnell, the third inmate, they make their move. They rush over to where the helicopter's going to be. And then they see it. A man jumps out of the chopper in a blue flight suit. He's an FBI agent. McNally's like, oh, he runs for it. He's going to try to maybe just hop a fence. Trapnell just lays down in the grass and waits for guards to come over to him.
Yeah.
The men now face new charges, attempted escape, new air piracy charges, and kidnapping. Trapnell had a new plan. Barbara Oswald's teen daughter would help them bust out.
Yeah.
She would hijack a plane and demand that the two skyjackers be released. So move on to the next part of their plan.
The family that jacks together.
December 21st, 1978, the men arrive in court as co-defendants for their trial. Good to her word, Oswald's teen daughter Robin did indeed hijack a TWA plane flying out of Louisville, Kentucky.
God bless.
She had on her a fake bomb made out of road flares.
I remember that. Yeah.
Trapnell didn't trust her to use a real bomb or even a pistol. So he's like, yeah, get some road flares. Tell him it's a bomb. He was worried about people getting hurt by her. He's like, she's a teen. I don't know what she's doing. Might actually hurt somebody.
Her brain's not fully developed.
So she skyjacks the plane on its way to Kansas City, right? On a lunch break in their trial, McNally and Trapnell, they're smoking cigarettes in their holding cell, waiting to be released and transported to the local airport to join the teen skyjacker. They're just like, should be any minute now. So they never get released, Elizabeth, because Robin Oswald gave up after 9 hours. She's like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Remember,
yeah.
Once again, teenager. So that same night, the jury returned a verdict in McNally and Trapnell's trial, guilty on all counts. McNally received a second life sentence for air piracy, also 75 years for kidnapping, another 5 years for attempted escape. He was scheduled to be released from prison in 2082. I mean, like, are you kidding me? So McNally, he eventually, because of the American legal system, he earns parole. Hey, I don't know how he's facing all those
why
years.
Not?
They're like, let's just knock him down, right? That's why people say years. I'm like, none of this matters. This is like my economics math when I was in my 20s. I'm like, none of this matters. The bank says this is fraud. I don't know. You can't write a check to yourself? So anyway, as McNally said at the time, quote, I've come further than most people would reach. I never thought I would get out of prison. Very few people have had my opportunity, which is a very powerful understatement.
Yeah.
But Trapnell, he's gone now. He's passed away. He died in prison. So McNally is the only one left from the golden era. He is the last of the skyjackers.
Wow.
As McNally puts it, quote, there's nobody else. I'm the last of the people who know the facts.
Huh.
So Elizabeth, I ask you, what's our ridiculous takeaway here?
Oh man. I think that I can understand why there were so many skyjackings because it just seems so easy.
Yeah, totally. And then like, they don't plan to hurt people. So it's a big bluff.
Yeah, it's one big, exactly.
Except for the political people, they will blow the stuff up.
Oh, yeah, they totally
will. You know,
will.
Like that's not, they'll take you to Algeria or whatever.
Yeah, But like for just the guys who want cash.
It's
like,
just a bank job.
Yeah, completely.
The bank's in there.
Completely. Zarin, what's your ridiculous takeaway?
You feeling all right? It's the voice, isn't it?
It's the voice.
Okay, well, I'm just going to pretend like you're normal you and be like, thanks for asking, Elizabeth, because mine is the bean farmer who found the money and decided to do the wrong thing, right thing, whatever. But if I had $500,000, right, and it landed in my bean field from the heavens, I'm going to say the Lord works in mysterious ways and I'm going to keep it moving. And that's it.
I mean, you figure you're living in a tiny town. Yeah. If you sit on it long enough,
yes.
Because if they have like the serial numbers recorded, like that's your concern, right? But if you start passing it in like two towns over, because they'll watch
over.
The local town though.
South America. I would take a trip like, honey, we're going on our second honeymoon. We're going down to Brazil.
But go wash the money.
Brazil's got, at this point, a dictatorship. Like we're good, baby. I can get this money through a bank. They will take any American money I bring into a bank, and they won't say where it came from.
I would just figure out a way to wash it slowly but surely. But, I'm not an ethical person.
I say dictatorship. I really should say military government. They were under,
Yeah, I wouldn't even go that far.
No?
A couple counties over.
Yeah, see, that's how you get busted, though.
Well, keep an eye on that area. But
banks are going to report to the federal banking system. So you want to get out of that.
That is true.
And then you also want people who don't care.
Do? I guess you go to casinos, maybe.
Yes, casino. Yeah. Well, casinos, it slows it down, but
still
report.
But in those days, they're not reporting it as tightly.
They're not reporting it tightly. That would be a good one. Yeah. I think a lot of people still use casinos for washing.
Wait 4 years and then drive to Vegas.
There you go. Yeah, you usually have to wait time. You just have to separate that
the
time.
Yeah, you got to put the time in there.
So I got another question for you.
Yeah.
You in the mood for a talkback?
I'm always in the mood for a talkback.
Yes. Producer Dave, hit it, please.
Talkbacks. Oh my God, did he just say that?
OMG.
Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, Zarin. My name is Danny. I love your show. I've listened to every episode. I'm a middle school theater teacher. And Elizabeth, this next part is just for you. Don't let Zarin hear this. Okay, Elizabeth, following up on my previous message. So this is some makeup that was donated to my class for our theater makeup unit. This is a Jurassic Park makeup line. Specifically, I needed to read you the packaging on the, quote, color-changing lip balm. It says, quote, life finds a way with this hybrid lip and cheek balm. Okay, so following up on previous message, this long-wearing formula is infused with hyaluronic acid to keep the skin nourished and, like a baby raptor taking its first bite, just a little bit packs a punch of buildable color payoff. Anyway, I found that ridiculous. I thought you might too, and you might want to try to spring it on Zarin sometime. Anyway, love the podcast. Thank you for all the work you all do.
Wait, what?
Oh, that's amazing. I will even admit that one's amazing.
I can't do that justice. We have to have it. Oh my God. Yeah. Packs a punch.
I didn't say that though.
No.
No one heard me say that.
No.
That's good. As always, you can find us online, Ridiculous Crime, on the socials. We have that website that we are very happy with, and we hope you dig it too, ridiculouscrime.com. And of course, as you can tell, we do love your talkback, so please go to the iHeart app and hit us up. And also, you can email us, if you like, ridiculouscrime@gmail.com. Type in Dear Elizabeth and type whatever you like. As always, we'll be back next crime. Thank you for listening. Ridiculous Crime is hosted by Elizabeth Dutton and Zarin Burnett. Produced and edited by our resident head pilot, Dave Kustin. Research is by our co-pilots, Marissa Brown and Andrea Song-Charpentier. Our theme song is by Navigator Thomas Lee and radio operator Travis Dutton. The host wardrobe provided by Botany 500. Executive producers are your helpful flight attendants, Ben Bolin and Noel Brown.
Ridiculous Crime.
Say it one more time.
Ridiculous Crime.
Ridiculous Crime is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.